for the week of May 29th, 2016. This is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 323, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in the doghouse, wait, am I still in the doghouse?
I don't know, but seriously, I mean, this week we have nothing to discuss, so maybe we should be fighting.
Maybe we should. They're really, it's Memorial Day weekend here in America. The UK has a bank holiday on Monday, so that's perhaps a bigger box office weekend for them if we're talking about movies. I don't know, the rest of the world, do people say, hey, the US and UK have the day off, we should have the day off too, or are those the only two countries? I don't know. But it's a holiday weekend, not a lot of news to cover, which means we'll barely be able to stretch the show to an hour and a half.
Yes, that's true. I mean, when right before we started recording, now, you never did truly introduce yourself.
In New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
Okay, well, Michael, you know, as we were leading up to recording the show, we were joking around that we could probably make it a half an hour show today, but let's face it, it's probably going to be 2 hours.
So what will we be talking about?
Apparently nothing, but we did find a few things, and on this week's show, we're going to look at the new fall TV schedule. The upfronts happened while I was away in Cannes, but we can still discuss the overall trends and why Grey's Anatomy is the perfect example of how new technology can boost long-running shows. We'll also discuss why Italian cinema operators are really upset that aliens won't be attacking Earth on July 6th, at least in their country. They're going to attack the rest of the Earth. They're going to leave Italy alone. I think the aliens like Italian food. During Inside Baseball, we're going to dive back into Viacom. There's a power struggle at the top, and one side wants to sell off a chunk of Paramount. Instead, is it possible Viacom would reunite with CBS? Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world. We have a link to RentTrack in our show notes. We also pull info from Box Office Profit and Mojo, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, The LA Times, you name it. The number one movie around the world is X-Men Apocalypse. It opened 2 weekends ago, I think, in a lot of territories. Now it's opened up in North America as well. It's made $120 million worldwide over the weekend, $250 million and counting. It's a decent start for the latest entry in the franchise. Now we're talking about the 3 to 4 day holiday weekend in North America, which technically should include Friday to Sunday, but then there's Monday, which we're still getting numbers on. And there's also Thursday because a lot of movies open on Thursday now. And for some reason, everybody talks about the 3 day weekend total and they include Thursday as well. I'm like, why not include Wednesday? I call again on everyone, Profit, Mojo, Variety. Compare 3 day weekends to 3 day weekends. If you want to compare Thursday to Sunday, that's fine. If you want to compare Wednesday to Sunday openings, Friday to Monday, whatever. But like, be specific and don't let them toss in an extra day's grosses and say, oh, what a big 3 day weekend we had. It drives me nuts.
You know, I can understand you're being driven nuts by that.
Well, because it's wrong.
Well, I would also point out that as far as RentTrack and as far as, you know, Box Office Mojo, they're only reporting the numbers they're given. And the studios want that number coming in on Thursday, the Thursday evening screenings. They want that number lumped into Friday for the very reasons that frustrate you, Michael. And I don't disagree.
They are third-party people reporting on them, Box Office Profit and Mojo and Variety and Hollywood Reporter. They are not the slaves of the studio. And the studio absolutely details what money was made on Thursday. And they can break it out. They know how to subtract, you know, $8 million from whatever the weekend total is and have a Friday to Sunday total. It is possible. It can be done. We have the technology. It's called math.
Listen, $6 million man.
Yeah, let's talk about the number two movie around the world, and then we'll discuss their fates. Number two is Alice Through the Looking Glass, the sequel to Alice in Wonderland. The book is not as good as the first book. The movie is not as good as the first movie, which itself wasn't very good if we're talking about the Johnny Depp version. This one stars Depp, but it was not directed by Tim Burton. It opened to $100 million worldwide. In comparison, the original opened to $114 million in North America. It was Johnny Depp was a big, big star, but this really tracked and opened crazily huge Nobody expected it. I think it was like March when it came out,
yes,
6 years ago. And that sort of helped create that sense that, you know what, you can open big movies any month of the year. They also said 3D was a big help. It was on the crest of that trend of people being excited just to see any movie in 3D. A lot of things made that first Alice movie a big, big smash hit. It grossed more than $1 billion. This one is going to be lucky to gross $500 million.
I remember when that movie was released in March of that year. It was 2010. And it was like right before Show West that year. And it was exactly what you're saying, Michael. It was a way for everybody to talk about how you can open movies any month of the year.
And this is a great example of, you know, the better movie you make, or at least the more entertaining audiences find it, the more money you'll make. And the worse movie you make, the less money you will often make. I mean, it's not always true. You can make a junky movie, but fans liked Transformers. They were happy with it, even though critics weren't. But fans and critics are not happy with either of these movies. Alice Through the Looking Glass especially got pilloried. The first one got mixed to poor reviews. This one is getting dreadful reviews. And you can see everything happening faster. If life feels like it's speeding up, just look at movies. You know, on Thursday, the tracking, Friday, the tracking, it drops every day because people are tweeting, they're Twittering, they're telling their friends. Word of mouth spreads at lightning speed now. So the people who saw Alice on Thursday said, oh my God, it's awful. And that hurt its weekend. X-Men Apocalypse, they're like, it's okay. You know, so it did okay.
You know, I couldn't help but think of you over the weekend, Michael, when I heard Joe Morgenstern of the Wall Street Journal. He's the critic there. And he is, I read his review and heard him read it on National Public Radio. And he said that he saw X-Men Apocalypse in the awful 3D.
Oh, they did.
Which he doesn't recommend. Of course, he doesn't recommend seeing it in any D.
In any D. I did not know anyone who saw that press screening, so that's interesting if they had the critics see it in 3D. That would mean if you care about the movie and want to see it, they feel the best way to see it is 3D. In that case, I would say go for it. If they show it to critics that way, they're making a statement because critics generally are going to be hard on 3D if it doesn't really deliver.
That's true. I mean, look at, you know, Michael.
Did you get figures on 3D breakdown? I imagine you didn't.
I did not, although...
it is a holiday weekend, so you might get figures tomorrow.
That's correct.
We're looking for a couple things from Sperling. We're looking for, like, year-end box office breakdown, like movies for their entire run and what they made in 3D versus 2D, at least for North America, if possible. Worldwide, even better. That would be awesome. Current movies, what their 3D breakdown is, if you ever hear it. You only get it from one company, though, right?
Well, it's very, yeah, mostly RentTrack is where you'll get that.
Well, RentTrack, but they will tell you 3D in general, not just the 3D success of real 3D or whatever.
Real D is who you're referring to. Yes, sometimes we'll get numbers from Real D, especially when they're good. They'll tell you the entire 3D box office and then what their portion of that was.
And his other bit of homework is to get that report about international and European box office and a list of them. We can perhaps divine what movies they were talking about when discussing the success stories of the last 5 years in Europe and the world and whether they were who and what they were referring to.
Correct.
All right. And number three around the world is the Angry Birds movie. Another $50 million, $220 million worldwide. That's triple their budget. Everybody's happy. It's my favorite app movie of the year.
Now, just I know you love that joke, but just so that we're clear here now, Alice in Wonderland was in 3D. It was one of the, you know, big early films after Avatar to come out in 3D. In fact, I think like 4 or 5 months afterwards, and which is what helped make it earn so much money in that March timeframe.
Some people say, yes.
Yes. And 59% of the opening weekend audience of Alice Through the Looking Glass saw the movie in 2D. Okay.
Oh, interesting.
Now, and I know you're going to love this, what I'm about to say, Michael. Mm-hmm. This is, despite more than 82% of the film's 3,763 opening weekend theaters premiering the film in 3D.
So say that in English. What was the percentage that were available in 3D?
82% available in 3D.
So almost every 4 out of 5 screens were 3D. And everybody jammed themselves into the 2D theaters.
Right. Now, what I will say is that is also a misleading figure, okay? I think, because just because 82% of the 3,763 theaters of Alice Through the Looking Glass's opening weekend theaters were 3D capable, it doesn't mean that they showed all screenings in 3D. They could
have that was certainly what they anticipated and wanted and made available.
Well, what
so they were saying, hey, we want you to see it in 3D. We're going to have as many. I mean, I don't know. I mean, that means they turn off the 3D screen and say, oh, it's a 2D screen.
Yes, they do that, especially in, let's say it's a fourplex. They'll take the fourplex. They'll get one screen. They'll show it twice in 3D and twice in 2D. So it's considered a 3D screen, yet it's really a split screen.
Well, I look at AMC Empire 25 in Times Square,
which not all theaters are, you know, that particular, you know, 25 plex, but yes.
Right now there are 9 screenings in standard 3D coming up.
Okay.
There's 3 in IMAX 3D and there are 6 in 3D alone. So it's about a 50% split as far as screenings that they are showing on display as of now for Monday at AMC 25. So it's a 50-50 split. That's as far as what they're showing, what they're selling tickets for right now. They're obviously not going to switch the 8 o'clock 3D screening to 2D. They can't because they've already started to sell tickets for that, right?
Correct.
I mean, at some point, they can't do that, I assume.
Well,
so
yeah.
The main point is they made a ton of screens available on 3D and people went to see it in 2D.
And the film opened in, day and date across 72% of the international world. Or international world, listen to me. The globe. It opened up in 72% of the marketplace.
Okay. It was a big wide worldwide release.
Correct.
And we were imagining it did better in 3D overseas, though it isn't doing that well anywhere. And number four
around
China the world
made $27.1 million, which is, you know, it's okay. It's not the $100 million that Jurassic World made.
At number four around the world is a movie that is doing well, Captain America Civil War, another $31 million, $1,107 million. At number five is Warcraft. That opens up here, what, next weekend?
I believe so,
very
yes.
Soon. This is a movie based on a video game, not an app. It grossed $31 million in about 20 territories. Mixed reviews. They're hoping, of course, to do very well overseas because it's looking to have a rough launch here in North America. It cost $160 million to make, and we'll have to see where it ends up.
This is Duncan Jones' big move toward the blockbuster world.
Well, and, you know, whatever the movie's fate, I would say it sounds like he did a capable, good job as far as delivering the movie as best as could be based on the material given. You know, he's moved up every step and made commercially successful movies. I don't think if this movie bombs as such, it would harm him particularly. I think they say, crappy property, but he did the most he could with it. That's what the reviews seem to be in the trades.
Well, yeah, and one of those trades, Alonzo Duraldi, who has been a guest here on the show a couple of times, he says, imagine Battlefield Earth without the verve or the unintentional comedy.
What trade does he write for?
The Wrap.
Oh, okay. And number six is The Jungle Book, $14 million over the weekend, $880 million worldwide. Will it get to $1 billion? Why do I care so much? But I'm just intrigued, even though I didn't like the movie. And number seven is Neighbors 2, Sorority Rising, $13 million over the weekend, $75 million worldwide. It's easy to forget how big the first Neighbors movie was. It made a ton of money. But hey, that's what sequels used to do in the old days, especially ones that aren't natural extensions of a franchise. This is sort of, you know, hey, let's make a little bit more money. The budget was twice as big, roughly. It's $35 million instead of about $17. All the big stars said, hey, you want to make another Neighbors movie? You made a lot of money. I want more up front. Makes perfect sense. They'll probably end up making their money. It won't be nearly as big as the first one, but everyone will be happy. And number eight is Money Monster, the Jodie Foster drama. $11 million over the weekend, $15 million and counting. And number nine is The Nice Guys, directed by Shane Black. People suddenly have affection for Shane Black, even though he wrote a lot of bad scripts over the years. But this movie made $9 million. It's at $26 million and counting. Not doing great. It's going to be a rough haul, but it's got a long ways to go worldwide. Will Russell Crowe and Ryan Gosling bring out the crowds in other parts of the world? It's got a 70s vibe. It's sort of a low-key action buddy comedy flick. For some reason, I kind of want to see it, even though it's probably not that good. And now there's Shane Black moving on to his next big project. He's going to direct Dwayne Johnson in Doc Savage.
Oh, okay.
You know Doc Savage?
Not personally, no.
I remember a bad attempt to launch a franchise with Doc Savage. I think it played on HBO about 1,000 times. I read one or two of the low-budget B-movie comic book, you know, novels. I don't know what to call these things.
They're
what
called
do you call
pulp magazine novels,
yeah,
but yeah.
Yes, pulp fiction, but this is like sub-level Pulp Fiction. Like, Doc Savage is like the poor man's Tarzan. You know, it's like Doc Savage is a step below some other franchises. I'm sure some fans of Doc Savage will not come out and yell at me. But this is sort of a little low rent, even for in the Pulp Fiction world. And they're trying to bring Doc Savage back. We'll have to see what happens. At number 10 is The Wailing, a South Korean thriller that grossed $5 million over the weekend. It's at $40 million worldwide. And one of my favorite movies of the year, Zootopia, another $5 million worldwide. I should be more specific, $4,800,000 worldwide. It's almost done in North America. It won't be in, it's still barely in the top 10. It may make a few more $100,000, but it's done in North America. It's at $991 million worldwide. It needs to make another $8,600,000 in order to get to $1 billion. It's only in 22 territories, but it made $4.8 million this weekend. Another two weekends with $4 million, and they will be there. Another three or four weekends, they can eke it out and actually cross the $1 billion mark. As we've been saying, there's about 25 movies that have grossed $1 billion worldwide. That's going to double in the blink of an eye.
Now, you mentioned The Wailing at $40 million total so far, the South Korean film. Just to give you some sense of how important that market is and how big it can be, all of that money was made in South Korea.
Right. No, it's a big movie-going country. They make a lot of, and they cross their movies over to other territories.
Correct.
You know, the South Korean TV shows and movies and pop music are very popular throughout Asia, and of course here in North America and elsewhere. So that, you know, is one of the many examples I had in mind when talking about European cinema. When you look at the big territories and the big, you know, thriving film communities that survive, it's not by making dramas in English. It's by making movies that will flourish in your territory. And when they're good and crossover, then you win again. But you can't play the worldwide box office game unless you're going to have budgets of $150 million, $200 million. So that's not the game you're playing. You're even if this movie, I'm sure, had a good solid budget for its country, maybe even a big budget. Maybe it was $15 million, $20 million to make, whatever it is. They want to make sure they can earn that money back in their own territory and that everything else is gravy, because that's what you got to do when you're playing with $15 million. And finally, Whit Stillman is back on top. Love and Friendship, a very well-reviewed Jane Austen adaptation from one of her epistolary novels, one that I haven't read, even though I've read and loved her main straightforward novels. $2.7 million over the weekend, $3.7 million and counting. It's starting to open up in some other territories a little bit. It's got a long way to go, but it's nice to see him back in the swing of things.
Well, it's nice to know that even when we don't have anything to discuss, we can still spend a good 20, 30 minutes on box office alone.
Oh, dear me. So what's happening in Italy? Why are they angry?
They are angry because 20th Century Fox has decided that they are not going to open Independence Day, the resurgence, the big, it is called Independence Day Resurgence, I believe. Yes. They're not opening it in July. Which is when they
in Italy.
In Italy, yes, they're going to open it in on September 8th, and in Italy, the summer box office is a graveyard. There's hardly any movies that do well in Italy during the summer. There's some talk about, well, everybody's at the beach, or you know, everybody's outside.
It used to be a problem throughout Europe, didn't it?
Yes, it did, and now that's not as much the case. But in Italy, it still is, and I guess Fox has decided to move it to September 8th because they had a very good way.
They don't want to waste their big movie in a summer that they think is slow going.
Right. They had an excuse.
They have an excuse.
Yes, which is, oh, we had a chance to kind of premiere it at the Caracalla Baths, so that's what we're going to do.
Right, right. And they're saying, liars.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, movies change release dates all the time, but when you say, no one goes to the movie in the summer, and they say, well, you're not opening any movies in the summer. The big change in Europe, I think, was when they got air conditioning, wasn't it?
Yes, that actually is very correct. A lot of that was, you are stuffing a whole bunch of hot, sweaty people into a hot box with no air conditioning.
Even into the 70s, you weren't finding a lot of air conditioning in the UK.
That's,
you know,
correct.
When you would go to a movie, it was hot. And there's also, they're competing with World Cup every 4 years. There's just a lot going on in the summer. And they feel like, look, but as we would say in the US, you know, there's money to be made. And you need to start releasing movies in those dates or you're not going to do it. And they announced it and they said they would do it and they're backing out, which makes it even worse, right?
Yes. Well, and so the people who are upset in Italy, of course, are the cinema owners who need something in the summer to bring
people
in.
And perhaps movie fans who don't want 27 movies coming out all in September and October.
Right. And, you know, there is something to be said when you have a big movie like Independence Day Resurgence. opening in your theater, you get to advertise other movies that might be opening in later July or August. And if you can't have like a knock-on effect, if you will, unless you have a big movie like that. You have to have the first knock before you have the knock-on effect.
We're talking Italy, right? What's going to be a huge grossing movie in Italy? I mean, Fox is squandering the opportunity to build up an audience in this territory in, you know, 3 months of the year because they're worried about, you know, a couple million dollars. I mean, what's at play for them? It's not like China. They're trying to get the best release date in China. We're talking Italy, which is a small market where they can afford, I think, to invest in putting a big movie in the summer and helping to build that audience. Maybe the next movie too, or maybe they'll reap the benefits even more 5 years from now once there's a thriving summer-going movie audience in Italy. Maybe this first one won't make as much money as it could have in the fall, but that's an investment you make in order to have a long-term, thriving, year-round movie-going audience in Italy.
Well, and Italy, I'm just, it just so happens, by the way, that thanks to Cannes, I have, and the Marché du Film, I have in my hot little hands here the Focus World Film Market Trends book. And last year, top 20 films by admissions in Italy, number one was Inside Out, okay? And again, they do it by admissions. So
that's awesome, right? Okay.
4 million admissions for Inside Out. Minions had 3.5 million admissions. 50 Shades of Grey, 2.8 million admissions.
So if we're talking about what might they charge in Italy for a ticket, $10 US?
I have no idea.
Right, let's make up a number of $10, which is awfully high. It won't be that high. But European prices are higher, at least in the UK for movies. Let's say you got $10 million US, so you're looking at $30 million, right? $30-40 million,
exactly,
for 4 million admissions. Mm-hmm.
The average ticket price, now again, this is the average ticket price, and they have for the US 6.9 US dollars,
this, right.
And 6.2 euros. So that should give you some sense of, hey, it's not exactly.
It's an important, every market matters. And we're not trying to downplay, we're just saying, look, you know, you've got to invest, you've got to take the knock and put a movie there knowing maybe you'll make less than you would have in some other time slot. But guess what? Down the road, that's really going to pay off for you.
And 665 million euros is how much Italy made last year in box office.
All right. Well, we've also got television. While you were in Cannes getting all this fun facts about worldwide cinema.
Hey, can we just like for a second pause and give myself a pat on the back for like literally whipping that out? Like,
no, because you could have done that last week or the week before when we were talking about European cinema and gone with France. What were the big French movies and French made films?
France?
We don't need to see this study. You can look at what were the big French films in the French territory this year.
Well, you know, if you were me...
there you go. There's our answer. We don't need to depend on this study. We can say, well, let's look at what movies France made that worked and see if they followed this formula and see what lessons can be learned from looking at them.
Well, you know, actually in France last year, 2015, 64.5% of the films that made up the market.
Well, they have legal requirements as far as what movies are screened, et cetera.
Well, that they were, imported. So 35% are homegrown.
Yes, but we're talking about the movies the French cinema industry made. We're not talking about Hollywood movies, unless this study somehow says, wow, the most successful movies are from Hollywood. Therefore, I assume they're talking about the French made films. What French movies were made? What were the big 10 French films in France?
The New Adventures of Aladdin was the big winner there. The
not
big
a
French
drama and not in English.
No, none of these would be in English because, you
know. Okay, none of them. Zero.
It had 4.3 million admissions to Star Wars, which had 6.7 million admissions. That's the number one film.
All right, number two in the French film?
Number two French film, wow. Les Profs 2.
Oh, right, the comedy, the broad comedy, Professors 2, yes.
And so that was
comedy.
The number in 710 films in France last year. I cannot believe we're doing this now. Daddy or Mommy was number 13 with 2.8 million.
Daddy or Mommy, I'm not sure what that is.
I'm not sure either.
I'm impressed that we are somewhat familiar with these movies just because we cover them every week.
That's right. And then all the way down at number 19 is Pourquoi je pas mange mon père? How come I don't eat with my father? At 2.4.
Oh, right, that comedy about the children all marrying different religions.
Yes, I believe so.
Yes, I think that's what that one was, which I think is ripe for being remade, actually.
I think the Weinstein Company is doing so.
Oh, have they picked that up? I mean, that makes perfect sense.
I'm assuming they have. They do that all the time.
And Daddy or Mommy is also a charming comedy. All right. That's interesting. Keep moving on. So while you were in the, it is impressive you had that at hand. I'm glad you had that document there. See, print still has a purpose.
That's true.
And while you were in Cannes catching up on movies, we were being barraged with all the new possible big hit fall shows that are be coming out in 2016, 2017. It's called The Upfronts, isn't it?
Yes. Now, The Upfronts is where the U.S. television industry sells, I would say, 70-75% of its advertising, if not more, of its advertising space for the upcoming television season. And it's kind of interesting to me that there is still a television season, since there are shows debuting all the time. It used to be all the shows would debut in September and then run through May. Now you have shows, yes, a majority of them do still begin in September. And then there are the mid-season replacements that begin in January. However, now you've got shows debuting in March and April during the summer. So the season is kind of skewed.
I think it's quite true that it is not a fall season anymore. You used to hear about the fall. Maybe you'd hear about one or two shows that were coming in mid-season, but that would be weird. Now they use this time frame of the upfronts to discuss the whole year.
Yes.
A lot of time was spent talking about mid-season, a lot of time talking about shows that launched and succeeded in February and March and June and all that sort of stuff. So it really is year-long programming. So that's definitely one of the big trends, I think, coming out of the upfronts, that, yeah, they may use this as an excuse to get our attention, say, hey, look at us, we've got TV shows coming out, but they are not spending all their time talking about the 4 weeks in September when some of their fall shows come out. They are programming year-round.
Okay, well, let's look at what some of these trends coming out of the upfronts were this year. We had tons of movement on the schedule. That was one of the trends.
That's right. I mean, you saw last year was sort of a staid year as far as programming. This year, everybody made moves on almost every night. So along with year-round programming, a lot of movement on the schedule was a big trend. And it's kind of funny. I think it's twofold. One, people can follow a show a lot more easily. I think you're less worried. If someone's already programmed in their DVR to record that season, they're going to catch it wherever you put it. But number two, contrarily, I think scheduling really still matters. Finding compatible shows that flow together.
If you ask me what night a show is on, even a show that I watch,
it can be really hard. I agree.
I have no idea. You could hold a gun to my head and I might be able to tell you that Blacklist was on Mondays at one point. I've got no idea.
The Blacklist is on Thursdays.
Yeah.
It used to follow The Voice. Now it's on Thursdays. It's NBC's number two drama. It's a big success story, and it's spinning off, got a spinoff coming out in mid-season. So that's a great example of a show that moved nights, did tremendously well on Thursday for NBC, and is now launching a spinoff. Well, but yeah, Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, I love it. It's been renewed, but it's been exiled to Friday nights, which is like
great news
and terrible news. I'm like, no, because Friday nights is becoming again sort of a player in television. And I hope their fans will follow it. And I hope it's got a good pairing up with some other show. And I'm crazy about it. Clearly, the network likes it. They champion it, even though they've moved it to Fridays. Will it matter that it's on Friday rather than, I don't know. Was it Monday or Tuesday? I can't remember.
You know, in a way, it may not matter at all, since if you're not DVRing this, you know, recording it for later viewing, then you're doing it on demand. So
that's right. Another trend was shows moving from one network to another. It, you know, we always talk about it. If a show gets canceled, maybe HBO will pick it up, or maybe PBS, or maybe Amazon, maybe Hulu, maybe Netflix. Well, Supergirl moved from CBS to the CW, as if the CW doesn't have enough superhero shows.
And the funny thing is, you didn't mention HBO there, I don't believe. So it used to be, oh, well, somebody canceled a TV show. Will it go to HBO? Now you didn't even mention HBO.
That's right. And one other final big trend was that comedies are still clearly big players. Everybody's got their serialized dramas. It kind of drives me nuts sometimes. You feel like you have to take notes every time you watch a TV show. There's still a lot of money to be made in comedies. There have not been a lot of big blockbuster comedies in recent years, and everybody wants them. So you're seeing ABC with comedies on three nights and CBS, and everybody's saying, what kind of comedies are we good at? We want to do more of them. It's really hard. We can do it bigger and better than, you know, websites and cable shows, and we want to do it. But then you look at NBC, who used to be the king of comedy. They have two comedies on their fall schedule. Two. That's it.
Well, that was actually one of the, you know, Adweek's five trends. They said comedy is still the holy grail. ABC, in fact, now has three nights of comedy, and they're talking about how all of these networks now have their comedy night, with ABC having three.
That's right. So that's one of the five buzziest trends that Adweek defined as coming out of the upfronts. That's one of them, and I would say that they got that right.
Well, what about this one, down with digital? They're talking about networks are arguing that digital ads are far less effective than ads on linear television, ads, you know, traditional ads on regular TV.
Are they even dissing their own digital ads?
I don't know. That's a good
question. Because they're making money off ads that they show on their website, you know, embedded in the show. If you want to catch up on a show, you go to abc.com and you watch an episode, they're going to have ads there. Those are crappy ads.
I think they're really dissing, you know, Facebook has a platform, and Twitter has a platform, YouTube. Yeah. I think what they're
Our
trying
digital ads are great.
Yes. I think what they're trying to say is, hey, you know, that game is rigged. Don't bring your ad dollars to these new digital platforms. Keep them with us, which includes our own digital platforms.
What do you mean rigged?
Well, with these the digital platforms, like the Facebook platform, it's been surmised for some time, and actually accurately surmised, that if you watch like 1 or 2 seconds of the video, that counts as a view. So that when somebody says, oh, well, that video was viewed 200 million times.
They need a better metric than that,
right? Exactly,
obviously.
Yes.
That's just a bad statistic. Just like they used to do clickbait. Somebody clicked on a thing, or they suddenly say, oh, the more clicks you have, the more active your readers are. So suddenly, instead of seeing 10 photos scrolling down, you had to click and go through a slideshow, because every click counted as an extra click.
A page view, yeah.
Right. And now that's gone, right? Now it's about unique visitors and how much time they spend on your site. So if that's how they're doing video, that's stupid. And it should be something like 50% in all of it, you know.
Yeah,
if
well,
you watch
and YouTube
two
has
seconds of it, that does not count as a view.
YouTube has actually fixed that issue.
Yeah.
Facebook has not, and that's where the rigging comes.
Well, I'm sure. Well, that's rigging so much as just poorly done,
poor metrics.
Yes. All right. So I would say that is a valid. That you did hear networks doing that. CBS especially had fun making fun of digital ads and also making fun of their competitors. They'd say, "Hey, we've got actual hits." You know, you look at shows like Quantico and Blindspot. And they would say, yeah, you're getting extra percentage of this and that on DVR usage and Live Plus 3 and Live Plus 7. But overall, when you look at their audience, they debuted with like 7 million viewers and they end up with like 3 or 4 million. So they're fading during the season. They're not building a big audience or maintaining the people. We're keeping our audience. So pay attention to the full number, not just the overnights or not just the, you know, percentage increase from DVR. Who cares how many people watched?
Another trend they said is TV is the new movies, which is a horrible way of saying that, because what they're really saying is that TV rehashes movies more than ever. We've got now we had a bunch that failed, Minority Report and Limitless.
They've always done this.
Yeah. And now we've got Lethal Weapon, The Exorcist, Taken, Training Day, and Frequency. Now, you might recall some of the most popular television shows were
MASH.
That's I was going right for MASH. How did you know?
Everybody goes to MASH.
Yes, exactly. So here we've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 movies turning into TV shows this year.
I don't know how you do Taken other than it has nothing to do with the movie. It's just a middle-aged man kicking ass.
Yeah, pretty much.
I mean, it's not about kidnapping his family every week. And if it's about kidnapping his family and he gets them back at the end of the season, then they get taken again. Well, that would be dumb. Now his second cousin, twice removed, has been kidnapped. Clearly, it's just a kick-ass, you know, man. So who knows what that is.
Or basically, you've got like, you know, a middle-aged man constantly saying, I have a very particular set of skills. Skills I have acquired over a very long career.
I have no idea, but I'll bet it's that he becomes the person people turn to when they're in a crisis situation.
So it's like the A-Team, but with one guy.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that was one trend. I would say, I don't think that's a trend. I think they've always done that. I don't think it's particularly more than ever. If it is, maybe it's just a blip this year, but I think they've always adapted lots of movies, Private Benjamin, on and on and on. You know, nothing new. Every radio show became a TV show. They pull from movies, from radio, from books, you name it.
Well, what about this one? Time travel being a hot subgenre. We have Time After Time, Timeless, in which a villain steals a time machine to mess with history, Frequency, Making History, which is about a professor who creates a device to mess with recent history to improve personal lives. I want that device.
Right. It's not about like going back to George Washington. It's about going back to do a better job at the staff meeting.
Okay. I want that.
I think it's stuff like that.
I want that so that I can go back in time. Maybe we could do a better job on this particular episode.
That could happen too. That's more specific than saying that TV is now adapting movies. I'll say fine. That's an actual subgenre. I did notice that there were three or four shows involving time travel. So yes, it's a hot trend. I don't understand how Time After Time becomes a TV series. That's about H.G. Wells chasing Jack the Ripper into contemporary New York. It's going to chase him the whole series. I mean, I know The Fugitive worked, but in general, that doesn't sound like a great idea for a TV show. Ah, I missed him again this week. Ah, I'll get him next week, you know. And Frequency is not about time travel. In the TV show version, just like the movie has a guy, but in the TV show, it's a woman who talks to her dead dad over a ham radio, and they work together to solve crimes. Lovely. Wonderful. Nothing to do with time travel.
Then this next one is a little bit of an eyebrow raiser. Kiefer Sutherland is a trend.
He's a trend on his own.
He's good for him. He's starring, well, first of all, they're rebooting, 24, because why not?
And he's an executive producer on it. I mean, maybe he'll have a cameo and pass the torch, or maybe he'll pop in and go, every once in a while.
Maybe he'll
but
pop in and say,
I have
a particular set of skills that I've acquired.
Yeah. But it does not star him.
No. He does star in Designated Survivor. He is a cabinet member that becomes the president. So basically, Kiefer Sutherland is becoming a politician. First, he was protecting a politician. Now he's becoming one.
He's the kick-ass president everybody wants.
That's true. Maybe he can run for president.
Well, I don't think that's a trend. He's producing a show and he's starring in a show. Good for him. It's a good fall season for him. Everyone's excited by the 24 reboot. And people think that this ABC show is one of their hot properties. We'll have to see. It's sort of, we've seen it a million times. The guy, everybody else is wiped out. And the education secretary suddenly is the head of Battlestar Galactica. So that worked really well. Great show. We'll have to see how he does.
Well, Grey's Anatomy, when it first premiered, I guess 12 years ago.
Big hit.
That worked really well. And, like all shows, it began to taper off a little bit. But now, in its 12th season, it's on the rise again.
That's right. They really rebooted the show in a sense. They killed off Patrick Dempsey a year early. They then jumped forward in time. Speaking of time travel, they said, we're not going to deal with the aftermath of our star being depressed and sad over Pat. We're going to just say, it's a year later. We're not going to make light. We're just going to say we've moved on, which I think is a good choice to make. Otherwise,
when does she wake up in the shower realizing that the last two seasons were all a dream?
That's right. So they made smart choices there, and it all paid off. And the show's done really well. And there have been other shows that have done well in the ratings, well into their run, like Law and Order, pretty famously. For Law and Order, it happened because of the reruns. The reruns on cable were goosing people into saying, I love this show. And they don't really have to catch up with it because it's a procedural and every week is new. And the really big success of the reruns helped bring more people to the network show. Instead of saying, I can watch it on reruns, they said, I want to see new episodes when they come out.
And then they had like 500 spinoffs.
They did. So that those reruns going into syndication actually helped Law & Order run as long as it did and, of course, launch off all those franchises. And Grey's Anatomy, they say, is almost a test case for a show that's benefited from various bumps in technology ever since its beginning because it's old enough in 12, 13 years that it's seen lots of different changes. Among them, of course, the DVR. And among them, being able to measure the ratings of Live Plus 7, being able to be have seasons passed on Netflix and streaming video on demand. We hear about young people watching Friends and getting into that show. Well, they were started to watch seasons of Grey's Anatomy, and then there they are when they can stream seasons 1 through 8, then they start to watch the show. And so we're seeing the demos get younger, the show get more popular, 12 years into the run. Kind of amazing.
So that's where the technology comes in.
That's right. Streaming video on demand, DVDs of seasons past, DVR, so it's easier to stay on top of a season because, it's a serialized drama. It's a show where you really want to watch every episode. So when you have a DVR and you can watch 5 episodes at once, you're not going to miss them. They're right there on your cable box waiting for you. So I think it's a real test case, and it's a big deal when you can look at a show like this, and I'm sure some college student will do a paper someday on how Grey's Anatomy has tracked all the technological changes in television and benefited every step of the way.
Wait a second. You used a key phrase in there.
I did. Keep going.
And I think it's benefited every... No, wait. It was big deal. So it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, the FX TV series The Americans has just been canceled.
What?
Yeah, now when I read that line, I was like, oh, really? And then I read the rest. It's the most acclaimed show on TV, arguably, but fans aren't really angry. And I said to myself again, what? I'm pissed. And then I realized, oh, they're ecstatic. And why? Because the show has also been given an order for 2 more seasons and a total of 23 additional episodes. That way, the series can end in 2018 and shape the story accordingly. Now, everyone knows The Americans is going to end and might just do it in a way that allows this highly praised series to take its place among the best dramas of all time. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. This is how you do it in this day and age. You have to say there's a finish line. We're going to cross it. Don't squeeze out every episode you can. Maybe they even went a season too long. I don't know. But at least they're, you know, doing what they should to let the show end well and be more valuable to them down the road as a library property.
So now, okay, this is a show about two American spies. Well, they're in America, but they're Russian spies living in America, kind of like a sleeper.
Right, you know, sleeper cell, covert agents in America pretending to be patriotic Americans in Reagan's America in the 1980s.
Yeah, and it's a great show. What I would say is it would have been interesting if they did like 9 seasons to match like the entire 80s, 1980 to 89 and the fall of the Berlin Wall and what happened there. That would be interesting. Although I guess they could still do that, right? I mean, they could just jump ahead in time. Hey, speaking of time travel, they could just, say 5 years later in 1990, here they are and the Russians have kind of left them out to dry.
And speaking of technology, I haven't kept up with the show. I'd like to. I watched the first few episodes and I didn't stick with it, even though I was intrigued. And now I know, oh, hey, I've got 2 seasons to go. It's going to end. People have loved seasons 1 through 4. So, you know, I know it's worth my time and I'll want to be part of the conversation when it's coming to an end. And maybe I'll do that via DVR or streaming video on demand or who knows what.
Yeah. And I can tell you that at least for a lot of the foreign film critics that were in Cannes this year, they all talked about The Americans and how much they loved it.
And we will never find out how much money it's made worldwide.
That is correct. No,
they don't want us to know how successful and how much money they're raking in from The Americans all around the world.
It's made no money. In fact,
yeah, we've made tons of money, but we don't want you to know.
In fact, we're going to have to ask the stars of the show to return their paychecks.
Yes.
Presidential candidate Bernie Sanders criticized the Walt Disney Company while campaigning in California. The company behind massive multi-billion dollar franchises like Marvel and Star Wars and, well, everything Pixar, frankly, not to mention theme parks and more, was taken to task for the wages it pays workers at Disneyland. And this is a quote from Bernie Sanders. He said, "The company makes billions of dollars in profit, but they are paying workers at Disneyland wages that are so low that many of the workers cannot find housing and they have to stay in hotels." And that's what Sanders told.
He sounds more like Larry Sanders, but okay.
Exactly. He told supporters at a rally in Lancaster last week. He also chastised them for manufacturing Disney merchandise overseas. CEO Bob Iger responded on Facebook that Disney has created 11,000 new jobs at Disneyland in the past decade. He didn't mention the average pay for those jobs or the fact that his take-home pay in 2015 alone was $46 million. I wonder if they all got $46 million. I doubt it. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop.
Yeah,
because it was not followed up. Variety and The Hollywood Reporter had fun reporting that this happened. But there's 2 things interesting here. One, that he responded on Facebook, which perhaps was not a good idea. I would have loved to have seen the comments people left about that. Maybe you can't leave comments on a corporate page like this. But I imagine people retweeting and saying, oh, yeah, you know, there are jobs posted for Disney World in Florida at $10 an hour. Well, that's $19,000 a year before taxes. Thank you very much. So, I didn't think he responded very well. I was surprised he responded on Facebook. And what I really wanted was for them to follow up and say, okay, yeah, you created 11,000 jobs, but what's the average pay? What's the starting pay? What do people actually make at this multinational corporation that is raking in billions of dollars? And that's something nobody did.
That's true. Although if you read the article, it was a great piece in the New York Times Magazine a couple weeks ago on Ben Rhodes. He is a former novelist who actually went on to become a head speechwriter and has helped shape foreign policy during the Obama administration. It's a great piece if you get a chance to read it. One of the things he talked about is how because of the media, well, mainstream media and newspapers kind of taking a hit advertising-wise. They basically have let go all of their big reporters, and they have a whole bunch of quote-unquote 20-year-olds running around being told what to write by people like Ben Rhodes and how he can shape a story just by telling the journalists what to write. And this was kind of a clear case of that. You know, the Sanders campaign wanted this story to be told a certain way. Variety and all the trades did exactly that, and they didn't follow it up. What I think is interesting here, Bob...
No, they would have followed up by building on what he said, not by taking it apart as such.
Right. Well,
he would have been thrilled if they'd followed up with actual substantive questions about, well, what do workers make at Disney World and Disneyland? He would have been happy with that.
Yes. But again, they're in the middle of a campaign and the talking point was said, and that's pretty much as far as it's going to go. What is interesting.
Yes. Superficial journalism and the gutting of the industry because there are no jobs left. Yes.
Yes. Now, Bob Iger responding via Facebook because apparently the PR department was on vacation and PR Wire closed down for the weekend. I don't know why. However, I do know why. And here's why. Sheryl Sandberg is on the board over at Disney. Okay. So she's a board member. Sheryl Sandberg being the chief operating officer, the big head honcho over there at Facebook. There is some discussion now that Thomas Staggs is out of the running as the successor for Bob Iger. He was the, you know, hand-picked protege of Bob Iger who was going to take over.
But she might be in the running to be his number two, yes.
Yes, that basically Sheryl Sandberg is being looked at. But, and this is coming from inside...
She's on the board. It's not a secret.
Well, it's a secret that, not necessarily a secret, but the murmurings that I'm hearing from people who are close to the board is that all of a sudden they're looking at her as possibly replacing Bob Iger. I don't necessarily know that that's such a smart idea.
Well, I mean, that's got nothing to do with him posting on Facebook in response to Bernie Sanders.
No, I mean, I thought
he didn't need her permission to do it, nor did he need her suggestion. So that has nothing to do with it.
No, but it was a way for me to talk about it.
Okay.
Talk about my inside information.
Moving on.
Okay. Well, okay. Then let's move on to streaming video. Streaming video on demand, it continues to grow by leaps and bounds in the U.S., but those leaps and bounds are a little bit smaller. Spending on SVOD services like Netflix, Hulu, and Amazon Prime will jump by 22% in 2016 to $6.62 billion. That's $1.1 billion more than in 2015. However, that dollar amount increase is a tiny bit less than the $1.21 billion increase in 2015. And this is the first time in history, at least the history of streaming digital video, that the increase has been smaller than the year before. Big deal or big whoop?
I have to say big whoop, right? It's a maturing industry. It's still growing by $1 billion a year. It's just slowing a little bit. Makes sense to me.
Yeah, and I would agree. You know, this is a projection, so it's not even an, you know. It
hasn't happened yet,
yeah,
but
exactly.
We're halfway through the year.
Exactly. So call me in 2017 when you got the numbers.
And, you know, it now says 40% of homes subscribe to at least two streaming video on demand services. So you may have cable and you probably also have Netflix and Amazon Prime.
And what I would say is very often the Amazon Prime of it all is that they got Amazon Prime for the delivery aspect of it,
Right. They do also break it out and make it available on its own, don't they?
You can buy Amazon
TV for like $8.
Yeah. So they just started doing that. But I've had Amazon Prime long before they had Amazon Prime Video.
I would always want those numbers to include a breakout of not just lumping all Amazon Prime in there, because that's a big number.
Apparently, it won't be a trilogy. Now, you might be asking, what am I talking about? I'm talking about director Sam Mendes, who helmed the two most successful James Bond films in franchise history.
Not adjusted for inflation.
But I can tell
you.
Yeah, thank you very much. I can tell you one thing. He will not be directing a third. Mendes bowed out after Skyfall, took the secret agent all the way to the billion-dollar club, and Spectre came close to doing the same. He had no particular reason for deciding to call it quits, just a desire to do something else. No word yet on whether star Daniel Craig will be on board as well, though he's contractually obliged to do so. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop. You know, the franchise is bigger than any individual director. We've seen directors return again and again to the franchise a couple times in its history. That's always been fun. Obviously, Sam Mendes did it. And we talked about the late Guy Hamilton, who did it a number of times and very successfully. It's a good idea if you find somebody who works well with you. I guess he just felt like, you know what, I spent 3 years on each movie and I'm done. But
yeah.
I think it's obviously much bigger than any one person, and it will be just fine.
So, you know, I actually, there were some rumors circulating. I saw it, believe it or not, on Facebook that Jamie Bell was meeting to discuss the role of James Bond.
That works
Bond.
For me.
It does.
He had a meeting?
Yeah, that he actually.
He had a meeting. Was it who reported that? I didn't see that.
It was on Facebook. It must be true.
Oh, my God. Stop saying that. So you know, Jamie Bell, again, would be an interesting choice because it would pull it away from what Daniel Craig was. You want to do something different. You know, he's small. He's not obviously the big burly
bruiser.
He's
my height, okay?
Right.
He's literally
my height.
So
he would bring a different vibe and feel to James Bond, which is important. You can't do the same thing again and again and again. So I think that would be, he's a great actor, really talented, and I'd love to see that. That would be fun. I wanted Christian Bale at one point, but then he did Batman.
Yeah, that's true. Actually, that would have been good casting.
I think he would have been great. Looked good in a tux, that's for sure.
A little Jamie Bell story.
Okay.
In 2000, we were launching Film Stew. We were at the Cannes Film Festival. And I was being interviewed on the Good Morning America equivalent, but in the UK. And so they were doing
the
all
Big Breakfast?
Yes, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, great show.
I didn't know it at the time. They were like, trust us, it's the big show. It's like Good Morning America, but in
it
the
was,
UK.
It was, it is.
I was like, whatever. Yeah, okay, I'll do the interview, whatever.
You were lucky to be on there.
I didn't realize it at the time. I like had... Anyway, I had no idea what I was getting myself into, but so I'm on this yacht, okay, that's parked there in the marina, and we're there with some star of some big buzzed about film called Billy Elliot and the director, and they were going on like in conjunction with us, so we were all on at the same time,
right?
And he was explaining what the movie was about. He's about a boy who likes to dance, even though his father wants him to box. I was like, okay, whatever. Little did I realize he can go on to become Jamie Bell. The film would go on to make $1 trillion and become a Broadway show.
That Big Breakfast ran for a decade from 92 until 2002. And Bob Geldof was behind it, one of the backers, his production company. So who knew?
Yeah.
Speaking of Broadway, that takes us to our next piece.
Yes, that's true. Broadway shows opening in the spring often hold on in hopes of Tony Award nominations or even wins or at least a big bump from performing on national television. But sometimes reality gets in the way. Two new musicals called it a day before the Tonys even air, and they couldn't be more different. Tuck Everlasting is a family-friendly show based on a best-selling children's classic. American Psycho, not family-friendly. It's a cold-blooded, sleek adult show about a serial killer. Yes, that's right. Two total opposites. But they both got slain, get it, by bad reviews and poor box office. Big deal or big whoop.
It's a big whoop, right? I mean, it's a shame for all the people involved, but it happens to most shows. Bright Star, the Steve Martin show, might join them soon, though they seem determined to try and hold on and build on goodwill and what they see with the audience reaction when you go to a show, which is why it's better when you're a Broadway veteran, because when you don't know anything and you go to a Broadway show and the audience stands and applauds at the end, you think they love it. But you know what? They do that at almost all new shows. When you're at a new show and the tourists and the people are there, they think it's part of, oh, you stand and you applaud. They think it's what you're supposed to do. So you think, my God, they're so happy. It's like going to Cannes and they give a standing ovation at the audience. Of course they do. It'd have to be really bad for them not to do that. So it can be a little misleading. You go and you see the audience reacting so positively and you think, oh, we just got to get more people to see it. I don't think Bright Star is going to make it any more than Psycho and Tuck Everlasting, but I've been wrong before.
You know, I talked to Sam Shepard after the premiere of Don't Come Knocking in 2006. This is the Wim Wenders film. And it premiered in Cannes. And then it premiered at Sundance in 2006, Cannes in 2005. And I talked to him afterwards. I said, you know, how do you compare the two premieres? And he said, Cannes was just surreal. He said, you know, the film ends and everybody's standing and applauding for like 10 minutes. He said it was just out of control, surreal, and almost fake. And I said,
yes.
Well, yeah. He said, here, the film premieres, and, you know, and then everybody shuffles out of the shuffles out of the little box that they're in. And I said, yeah, that's welcome to Sundance.
And the movie was not a success story.
No, not at all.
Sadly.
Now, let's face it, Michael. Having seemingly every movie, every song, every TV show, and every book available at the click of a button, including Don't Come Knocking, it's wonderful, you know, but it's also daunting. So the new sexy buzzword is discovery. You know, that buzzword comes from another buzzword called curation, the ability to match people up with entertainment they actually enjoy. When it comes to books, of course, you should head on over to Michael's website, bookfilter.com.
End of shameless plug.
Yes. When it comes to music, Spotify has a hit on its hand with Discover Weekly. This playlist launched in June of 2015, and 1 year later, it is working like a charm with 40 million listeners. Playlists geared towards individual listeners and new artists connecting with new fans via the playlist in ever-increasing numbers. I love this feature of Spotify. I use it all the time. I am amazed by it. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, you tell me, because I've never used it.
It is unbelievable. Like, you know, the algorithm that they use to go out, find new music that you may not have heard of, okay? And then say, you're going to enjoy song A, song B, song C. It's absolutely remarkable. Sometimes it's new music from artists you already know, like Ray LaMontagne. Sometimes it's new music from artists you've never heard of before and become a fan of. And what's remarkable to me is how accurate it is. And how I kind of go, yeah, I do like these songs. So it's
and
like,
you don't feel bad that it's not like Joe DJ helping you discover new artists.
No, the one thing I will say is, you know, the way they do this algorithm, if you fast forward through a song within the first 30 seconds, they're like, uh-huh, okay.
Sure, they learn from what you do. Of course, they wouldn't work otherwise.
Right, but after a while, it can become a little bit of an echo chamber, and all of a sudden, everything kind of like skews towards one style of music, I've noticed, that if you're not active in it, and you don't actually help it out, the algorithm out a little, then mm-hmm. it can get, I don't want to say stale. Because
you can't use it in the background. You have to actively say, I like this, I don't like this, this is boring me.
Yeah, every once in a while, you kind of have to go through it again and go, okay, yes, save that song, like that song. You know, yeah, you kind of have to play that song again.
So they've just got a good algorithm going? Is it the design of the app? What else is working for you here?
Do you recommend
it to other people?
I do, actually. I mean, as a matter of fact, I'll be honest, I'll go to Spotify. That might be the only thing I listen to on Spotify for 2-3 weeks straight.
Mm, all right.
And there's no other reason than, you know, time is short and, you know, I'll be going to Cannes. I don't have enough time to listen to Spotify. And hey, but you know what? Let's check out the Discover Weekly.
So it's a great tool. Yes. It does not make you want to, you still pay attention to reviews, I imagine, and to other elements. You know, it shouldn't be your only source of new music, but it's a great tool. Is that the idea?
Yeah. What's a review?
Never mind.
No, I get Rolling Stone. I know what a review is.
Yeah. Keep going. Inside baseball.
Okay, well, I guess then let's wrap up Big Deal or Big Whoop and move along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. This week's story, I'm not sure how this will affect our listeners other than, first off, it's pure speculation. So let's start there, okay?
I would end there, but it's your choice.
Yeah, it's called a slow news week, Michael. This is we're suffering from a slow news week itis, and we're trying to make the show 2 hours long. So really what we're talking about here is last week we talked about Viacom and Philip DeMond, the CEO, kind of being taken out of the trust that will one day control Viacom. This week we are talking about how part of the reason or speculation for why that may have happened, why Sumner Redstone, the ailing Sion,
and or his daughter,
and or his daughter had kind of removed him on from that role as the trustee, is that he is thinking about selling Paramount Pictures and Paramount the studio.
A stake in Paramount Pictures.
Yes,
right?
Correct. And now, back in 2005, Sumner Redstone split Viacom, which owns lots of cable networks like MTV and VH1 and Comedy Central, and Paramount Pictures, split that company from CBS, which was also owned by Viacom. Now CBS is its own public company. And part of the reason for doing that was he had, Sumner Redstone had two big, I don't want to say moguls, but certainly two big executives he was trying to please, Leslie Moonves over at CBS, and at the time, Tom Freston at Viacom. Now, what's happened is Freston's...
And a lot of times people say you can increase value by splitting things apart. They can be valued more completely for what they are. So
right.
CBS perhaps is appreciated more on its own rather than when it was part of the Viacom empire.
Right. Rather than have one big company, why not have two big companies? That's
exactly
basically what they're talking about.
So they split
about.
Them apart. They're separate. And now people are saying, well, on the one side, Philippe DeMond wants to sell off a chunk of Paramount. On the other side, you have the Sherry Redstone camp saying, not only do we want to keep Paramount, maybe we want to bring back in CBS.
Yeah, I mean, CBS here, you know, they're making lots of money. They're a very successful company. Viacom stock has fallen 45% in 2 years. So,
and CBS has run very well. Would it mean Les Moonves was in charge of Viacom?
That's what the thinking is, that Les Moonves
Why would Sherry Renstone bring someone in to take over the job she wants?
There's some talk that she doesn't necessarily want the job. She just wants to be in control. She wants to be chairman. She doesn't want to be CEO.
If you're chairman, you're in control. That's the job, isn't it?
Well, if you're chairman, you're not in day-to-day control. In other words, you don't actually have to do
that's what
the
you
job.
Think.
Yeah, well, you know, I've worked with a number of chairmen, and I can say I showed up every day. They didn't necessarily.
All right, right.
So Redstone, you turned 35 on Friday. This is, Sumner Redstone. So he's now officially 93 years old. Didn't have a big party like he did when he turned 92. But
we did have a party. It was a different guest list, I thought.
Yes, a small guest list, i.e. his family. So
I thought there were players, but it wasn't the Viacom people because they were on the outs.
Yeah, no, nobody from none of the big Viacom people
to
showed up.
To tell you how well CBS is doing, Les Moonves got $56.4 million in 2015 in compensation. Philippe Demond got $54.1 million, so a whole $2,300,000 less.
This is really the figure that states everything about the two businesses and why CBS is worth so much money. It also, in my opinion, if you look at this, what I'm about to say here, this statistic, you're really finding out why your cable bill is so high and why everybody is racing toward television and television networks in some way. Okay, so this is a story from the LA Times that Meg James, a former guest here on the show, has written. CBS is earning an estimated $1 billion this year from retransmission fees. These are the fees that CBS can charge to cable operators and satellite operators for retransmitting its signal. So $1 billion a year from retransmission fees. That figure is up from $150 million in 2010. So just 6 years ago, it was $150 million.
So it's increased six times over.
It's remarkable.
Over 600% increase. You know, it's sextupled, whatever that is.
Yeah. If you want to know why your cable bill is so high, that's the reason right there.
Well, you know, Viacom has had a bad year. In 2015, it grossed $13.3 billion in revenue. That was a drop of total return of 42%. But CBS dropped 14%, by the way, as well. But they grossed $13.9 billion. So they grossed more money. He made a little bit more money than Philippe. But they're both raking in the big bucks, aren't they? We have a link to the top highest paid CEOs in North America. This does not include hedge fund managers and people like that. It's just corporations.
This is just media CEOs, yeah.
But it's not just media companies, not at all. It's all the CEOs, but you will see the media companies right up there. CBS Les Moonves is at number two. Expedia is at number one. Viacom is at number three. Disney Robert Iger with $43 million. He's, you know, number eight or nine. So you'll see lots of big entertainment conglomerates in that mix. So do you think it'll happen? Do you think if CBS takes over Viacom, will it be more like Pixar being bought by Disney, where Pixar was bought by Disney, but in fact the Pixar people took control in many significant ways, certainly of the animation department?
Yeah, well, I do think that this is something that is likely to happen. There's some... Yes, I think...
You think it's going to happen?
I think that there's enough talk about it now, mostly from insiders who are saying, look, this is where we think it's going. And of course, from the street, people saying, hey, it would be great if Leslie Moonves could take over Viacom and you could join those two companies. The tricky part is that the buyer and the seller in this case would be on the same side, since it would be National Amusements, the company that controls the voting shares of both companies. So you know, how do you negotiate when you're both the buyer and the seller? And how do you do it in a way that's fair to shareholders of both companies?
I don't know if it's likely. I mean, it's possible, of course, but does it seem likely? I mean, there's such big, huge companies, and they just split up a little while ago.
And I'll tell you,
who gets to be in charge?
Leslie Moonves was none too happy. I mean, all of the TV assets were kept with Viacom except for CBS. So he went off and started, you know, CBS Productions instead of Paramount Television.
Yeah.
He's got a little bit of a beef, I think.
Well, and he's got bragging rights too, right?
Yeah, well, successful bragging rights, that's for sure.
Absolutely. So if he wants to contact us and tell us how well he's doing, how would he do so?
He would write a check to Showbiz. Yeah. No, he would call us 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. He can also write to us and send us an email, dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Of course, you can subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, the Google Play Store, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can subscribe to us, rate and review the show. It does help us out when you do that. All of that information, as well as links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode, can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find ways to follow us on Twitter, @showbizsandbox. So, Mr. Moonves, again, you can follow us and, you know, direct message us on Twitter. @showbizsandbox is our handle. Like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. All of that information on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their own website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it is loamolitalia, iloveitaly.com.
Wow, I can't believe you actually tried to speak a foreign language on the show and did a better job than when I tried to speak French. In any case, if you can't find any of Michael's writing and coverage of the entertainment industry there, head on over to the Huffington Post or trymichaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Of course, you can always check out bookfilter.com. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.